The Anton Savage Show with Kearies.ie on News Talk.
My next guest is a professor of disability research, a sociologist, bioethicist. He's now the author of A Reverse Whodunit About a Pig Who Steals a Manuscript, possibly also consumes the manuscript, but spoiler alerts. Tom Shakespeare joins me now. Tom, good morning.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
Tom, the new book is The Haha, and we will talk about that in a minute. Before we get to it, there is an interesting set of overlaps with Ireland and you that I wanted to address. Starting with your grandfather, who was privy to the treaty negotiations in 1921.
Exactly. So he was the secretary to Lloyd George, and he met Edmund de Valera and Michael Collins when they were negotiating the treaty with the British authorities. And in fact, when they had finished negotiating the treaty, they had to obviously go to Belfast to tell the unionists what was about, and they had to send somebody, and they sent my grandfather, and he took Lloyd George's great coat because he had no overcoat. He took a train to from Euston up to Holyhead, and a frigate or some similar ship to Belfast, beg your pardon. And there he talked to the unionist leader, and the Six Counties was born.
And of course, that was his memoirs of that have been hugely useful in giving an insight into the negotiations and the thinking of Lloyd George. Did your lives overlap? Did you know him?
Yes, I did. So as a child, I think to the age of 13, I knew him. He was obviously a respected figure. He'd been I'm responsible for slum clearances and evacuations and all sorts of junior minister business when he was in the coalition governments in the 1930s.
Did you ever talk to him about the treaty negotiations? I realise from your side of the water, it is probably less significant than from our side, but it's unusual to speak to somebody who has first-term relationship with somebody who was actually there during that.
I'm afraid I didn't. I was too young. Later, I saw the photographs, for example, of him with Michael Collins, and I realised what a part he'd played at the sidelines of great negotiation. I knew that he was, a follower of Lloyd George. And my grandfather, in fact, took my father to visit Lloyd George when my father was very young, maybe 8 years old. And Lloyd George said to him, you know, I've commanded the fate of armies and navies, and here am I collecting dandelions for my secretary's rabbit. So I can honestly say my father knew Lloyd George.
Now, the other thing, by the way, when we're talking about your father that I'm intrigued by is both your grandfather, father, and you share the title of baronet. You don't use it. Why?
Well, I didn't earn it, so why should I use it? My grandfather retired from government in the 1940s and was awarded a baronetcy. So he earned it. My father inherited it, and he knew his father very well, obviously, and he used it, and he was a great doctor and was proud of it. In my turn, I don't use it. I don't agree with inheritance. I think that what you earn by your own merit, maybe you can use, like professor or whatever it might be, but, you know, being called sir just because your grandfather was a liberal politician, it doesn't ring with me, and I therefore never ever use it. I'm rather embarrassed. It is technically what I'm known by, but it's never what I would present to the world.
Have you considered the sacrifices you are making? Think about how easy U.S. immigration would be if you were able.
It would be easier, and maybe tables at restaurants and so forth, but I have principles, and I'm not prepared to compromise them.
The other Irish link, I mentioned the 1921, your grandfather's being part of the treaty negotiations when he was private secretary to Lloyd George. The other thing that you did was you went to Cambridge and decided to study ancient Celtic.
Well, I studied Anglo-Saxon, Norse and Celtic. That was my first degree, as it were. But I'm afraid Old Irish, even Medieval Irish, was far too much for me. Medieval Welsh is a closed book. So I studied Old English, and I also studied Anglo-Saxon, Norse and Celtic art and great artworks of Ireland and obviously the the wonderful books of illuminated Bibles and
Durrow and Kells,
Durrow and Kells, and it was a great thrill to me to go to Trinity College Dublin to that wonderful library and see the Book of Kells, which I'd studied. What a masterpiece! What a wonderful thing! And ironically, well, maybe not ironically, but I've always loved Irish literature. You know, Flann O'Brien and James Joyce and Samuel Beckett and all the rest of it. I've loved them and read them. And 20 Years of Growing and the Blask Islands and so forth. So obviously, I have a great love for Ireland.
Do they read as well to English eyes? Because Flann O'Brien did such a good line in parodying things that you sort of take to be innately Irish, almost like a Father Ted of his time, or a Dermot Morgan of his time. There was that sense that if you weren't of Ireland, you wouldn't get the joke.
Well, obviously, I miss a lot. I must miss a lot. And his novel, Anne Belle Bocht, I can't even pronounce it correctly.
He didn't do bad.
It was written in Irish and then translated into English. And I'm afraid I've only ever read it in translation. And the same with Crisín Lorne, which is his, as you know better than I, his column in the Irish Times. But I have read all of it in English. Sometimes he's fake Irish. Sometimes he's obviously parodying the Irish revival. I get a lot of it. And At Swim Two Birds and all the rest of it, I love and always have. There's a great Irish tradition of humour, which I've always enjoyed.
Well, now, this is the thing that I don't quite understand, Tom, is I could understand if a 20-year period had been removed from your life. So if we had you going from Cambridge and then getting into writing and then publishing The Ha Ha, I'd say, yeah, there's a logical flow. But in the middle of that is interposed a long time of stand-up comedy. How does that fit? Because
it wasn't a long time. It's about 10 years.
That's enough.
What your listeners probably don't know, because they can only hear me, is that I'm actually very short. I'm 4'5". I inherited achondroplasia from my father, and I passed it on to my children and grandchild. And therefore, I've always risked being laughed at because I'm rather unusual. People laugh. They think I've never seen a short person before. And I don't want them to laugh. It's very demeaning. It's very unpleasant. And therefore, rather than laugh at me, I want them to laugh with me. And also, there's the fact that when I meet somebody new, they're immediately a bit, as it were, freaked out because I'm not what they expect. And therefore, I have to put them in their ease. And the best way to put anybody at their ease is to tell a joke or to laugh. And they realize then that you're not bothered by it. They need not be bothered by it. And they can get on with being, hopefully, your friend. And that's how I've always been. I'm 57, I think. And I've had to, all through my life, use humor to put people at their ease, to stop them laughing at me. And therefore, it is inevitable. Or not inevitable, but it was natural that when I came to write, I would want to make people laugh.
And does it not become wearisome knowing that you're going to have that conversation with each new person that you're introduced to?
It is wearisome. You could argue that British media, I've always been. For a long time, I've been on the radio. So Radio 3 and Radio 4. And what you don't get, I wrote a column once, you don't get dwarfs on the radio. You can't see people. Whereas as soon as you're on screen, people are going, oh, look at that guy. He's a bit odd. Whereas in the radio, it's only your voice and it's your ideas and your humor and your ability to deflect or to answer a question, and then you are equal to anybody else.
That's interesting. So you would actually perceive a different set of interactions when you are dealing with people, either phone or radio, than face-to-face?
I think so. Well, I would worry that when I was on screen, what they were really fascinated by was how I looked, and they would, focus on that. Whereas when I'm talking, am I talking rubbish or am I talking good sense? That's the judgment people would make.
The other thing that you said in the midst of all that surprised me slightly, because the maths seems to be very close, you said you're 57 and already a grandfather.
I am. I started young. I got my breeding done early. And I had Ivy when I was 22.
Wow.
And she's now, I don't know what, she's nearly 30. Well, she's 35 and she's got a four-year-old. So I went up for Ruby's four-year-old birthday party in Newcastle last weekend. So it was a great trip, privilege. And it's a delight. And I've got a photograph of myself, my daughter, my granddaughter. And guess what? My granddaughter is making a face and sticking out her tongue. So even at an early age, she's realized that, you know, being silly is the way forward.
Tell us then about the haha, because silliness is interwoven throughout the entire narrative of it. Can I ask the obvious question about the title? Is it a laugh or a wall?
It is both. So a ha-ha, as you know, is a wall. It's a sort of infinity pool in grass, you'd like. It's a way of saying, you know, see this? I own all this. No fences, no hedges. But it keeps the sheep and the cattle away from your lawn, your garden. But if you don't notice it, you could easily walk over it. And I think the word ha-ha is the expression that the 18th century gentry made when people fell over their ha-ha. But it does play a role. It plays a role because what happens is our friends rent a stately home for the weekend. It's not where they live. It's a wonderful Georgian mansion, if you like, that they rent. And they can't, and I don't know if you've ever rented an ordinary country cottage, but you probably won't get reception for your mobile phone. And the main place they can rent reception is standing on the ha-ha. And of course, that's precarious. So if you fall over, then there's laughter at your expense.
This is, what's the character from the Simpsons? This is not Ralph, the bully, Nelson. This is your pre-Victorian Nelson, effectively, that the gentry of England were 150 years ahead of the Simpsons in pointing and
going.
Well,
they were quite cruel in their humour sometimes. They were quite cruel. And if you think of, I don't know, Pope or Sheridan or any of these great Georgian masters of humour, it was often at somebody's expense.
So you mentioned the setting for the book. The lead character is Fred. We have Fred, we have Heather, and then we have a mix of, there are some passages of significant intimacy.
There are, and they were a lot more intimate than that when I first wrote them. And my agent said, do not be explicit in what you write, because he will never sell to a lot of readers. So I'm worried about my mother reading it, but it's not particularly intimate. It doesn't use any words for body parts, but it's implied what happens. There's a wonderful, The Dead by Joyce, it ends with Snow's general throughout Ireland, I think, and there's a naming of everywhere there was snow. And after the act is finished, the dogs bark and they howl all through Suffolk and Norfolk. And I have this sort of ludicrous idea that the village dogs, the farm dogs, start barking and everywhere is barking as the act is consummated, which is very silly. But the whole point is meant to be silly. Fred is in a wheelchair like me. Why is he in a wheelchair? Because his parents were driving on the wrong side of the road and crashed. And he was flung from the vehicle into a nudist colony. And throughout his adult life, he's had a phobia of the naked female form. So whether or not he survives the weekend and the nudity that might or might not be involved is a matter of doubt.
You mentioned that he uses a wheelchair like you. The people will assume when you say that is a function of the, condition is the wrong term because it sounds pejorative.
No, he was paralyzed and I was paralyzed. So I was not always in a wheelchair. I became a wheelchair user in 2008. And as I say, I was born in 1966. In fact, the year when Flann O'Brien died, I think. And so I had had most of my adult life without a wheelchair. And then suddenly I found myself paralyzed and using a wheelchair. And in a way, I had to relearn what it is to be disabled. Now, Fred has the start on me. He becomes paralyzed at the age of 21. And one of the reasons that I wrote the book was to show that it doesn't make a difference to his life. That is to say, he has an adapted car. He has an accessible flat. He rents an accessible stately home, if you like. And he has friends. And he has a job. He's a solicitor. So in all respects, he is normal, if you like. But he happens to be in a wheelchair. But really, it makes no difference to his life. And that's the point that I wanted to make. I mean, it sounds like it's an obvious point. It's not hammered home, but I hope implicitly you see that he can have a good life.
Which, of course, is unusual in fiction. It is unusual to have a character with a notable attribute, whether that be a disability or anything
exactly.
else.
Exactly.
Where it isn't well, a catalyst.
Well, when it, exactly what you say, where it isn't a catalyst. So there are actually quite a few disabled people in literature. There's Tiny Tim in A Christmas Carol. There's Richard III. There are people like Blind to You and Long John Silver in Treasure Island. There are a few, but they're always, as it were, metaphors for something else, for evil or for pathetic hopelessness like Tiny Tim, or sometimes overcoming your infirmities. And triumphing in the end. So they're always a metaphor. And I wanted to write a character who is not a metaphor, who wasn't there to make us feel bad or good or whatever. He just happened to be in a wheelchair.
I'm intrigued by the. I think you are setting the record for people that I have talked to with most Irish literary references, and that includes a lot of people who are in the Irish literary sphere. I have to ask the question, because you quoted Joyce earlier on. Did you ever attempt to suffer your way through Finnegan's Wake?
Well, I read Ulysses and loved it, but Finnegan's Wake I had real problems with. And so I bought it as an audiobook and played it in the car. And that was the only way it got to the end. And I apologize to the spirit of James Joyce. I'll tell you a story. I was once traveling through Italy, and the young woman opposite me was reading a book that looked familiar. And I said, excuse me, is that Finnegan's Wake? And she said, yes, in Italian. So how on earth you translate Finnegan's Wake in Italian? You deserve a Nobel Prize for Literature merely for doing that.
I have to say, I don't know, you may be familiar with him because of the Joyce work, but there is a man here by the name of Senator David Norris, who is one of the leading Joycean scholars in the world. But where you describe the audiobook version, I once asked him to do, you know, I think it's in the early, maybe the first two pages of Finnegan's Wake, there is the onomatopoeic sound of thunder.
Yes.
He does it absolutely verbatim, the way it is written across the three lines Oh, it's remarkable. I was just wondering, what did they do in the audiobook? Did somebody take it on and deliver on it?
They did do it, but I will go back and have a look at how they, have a listen to how they did it. But I'm not sure, I listened to it, so I must know, but they must have done it, as it were, verbatim.
Now, how do you square this with the other person that I have, I've seen you quoted as being a big fan of, that being Douglas Adams? Surely science fiction and semi-philosophical, whimsical fantasy doesn't fit with an academic who is reading Finnegan's Wake by audiobook.
Well, I mean, there's, as you know better than I do, a long strand of slightly whimsical humour in Irish literature. I'm thinking of James Stephen's Crock of Gold, which is, there's a lot of it. And Douglas Adams uses, where does he get his humour from? I think he gets his humour from P.G. Woodhouse. And P.G. Woodhouse is writing about earls and aristocrats in a different world. And Douglas Adams is writing about, you know, the infinite improbability drive. But the jokes are not totally dissimilar. He knows how to make a joke, how to construct a character, because he's read so much P.G. Woodhouse. And I think the same is true of Terry Pratchett or many, many fantasists in English, that they use what they learned from P.G. Woodhouse in a very different milieu. And that's exactly what I've tried to do.
Going to challenge you with a trivia question. What is the Irish link to Douglas Adams?
I do not know. So please tell me. Please explain.
The rounding out of the trilogy, when Douglas Adams had died, the family asked Owen Colfer, the Artemis Prime, Artemis Fowl, I should say, yes. Author. So Douglas Adams has been written by an Irish guy posthumously.
Excellent. Well, I have read Ewan Colifer, so that is fantastic. I'm very pleased. I haven't read that book, and I will now go and find it and read that. But that's wonderful. But I think surely that humour, a parody, that satire is you find it in Flann and Brown, don't you? You find it, and I think that, for example, and forgive me, I'm not neither a senator nor an expert, but James Ulysses is funny. You're meant to laugh at a lot of it, surely. I believe James Joyce had a sense of humour, and if you read early Beckett, like More Pricks Than Kicks, there's a lot of humour there. Even Murphy or Watt, there's a lot of humour before he turns, I think, to the dark side of life.
Which he did with some commitment, it has to be said. When he went that way, he really went that way.
There's no doubt about that.
Tom, it has been a great pleasure talking to you. The new book, The Ha-Ha, is obviously out now in all good bookshops. The author is Tom Shakespeare. Tom, thanks again.
Thank you.
The Anton Savage Show
with Kiri's.ie
on News Talk.